Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm William English, and this is the latest episode in the ongoing series on autodestructive art, music, and film. Last week we had Michael Landy. Next week is a pre-recorded interview with Gustav Metzger. But this week it's Nicky Hamlin. Welcome to the show, Nicky, again.
Thank you.
Nicky Hamlin is the author of Film Art Phenomena and is an experienced filmmaker. I forget, what did you do at the London Film Co-op, Nicky? I can't remember what you were.
I ran the workshop for a couple of years.
Right.
With Susan Stein, who's another filmmaker, who still is a filmmaker.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And basically, we're going to try and talk today about sort of self-destructive film, if there is such a thing, the phenomena of anti-material, I don't know, immaterial film or self-destructive cinema.
Different kind of versions of that thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's no such genre as such, is it, in the way that there is auto-destructive art. I don't think there's ever been a kind of a movement of people sort of trying to promote the idea of film that destroyed itself for any particular reason.
Not specifically. I think there has been destructive kind of filmmaking, but that's not necessarily why people set out to do it in the way that Gustav Metzger set out to make his nylon paintings, you know, with acid. These works were made more as a way of addressing certain kind of ideas to do with audience, the institution of cinema, and things like that.
Right.
I suppose I'm thinking of Tony Conrad, who made a series of pieces which we can talk about, which involved pickling or smashing film, and then kind of somehow reconstituting them in some way or not.
Yeah, yeah. Perhaps we should backtrack a bit and talk about the history of film somewhat because the early film stock. Was, I think it was called cellulose nitrate, and was, and probably still is, if there's any around, is a highly volatile material, which I suppose kind of it was around until the 1950s, but did have suicidal tendencies, shall we say.
Yeah, and still does, and there's still a lot of it in the National Film Archive vaults in Abbots Langley or somewhere in Hertfordshire. I mean, apparently safety film was invented quite early on, but the film industry controlled the availability of safety film as a way of stopping other people from using film. So by saying, well, we professionals know how to use this dangerous stuff, it was a way of, partly a way of controlling the dissemination of film stock and the availability of film stock. And actually safety film was invented, as you say, the cellulose nitrate went on being used till into the 50s, but they could have switched over to safety film much earlier on.
It didn't. It would decompose in the tin, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think it just turns to sludge, and eventually gets more and more unstable. And there's that film Decasia by Bill Morrison, which is a rather kind of romantic piece, but it's all made from very deteriorated nitrate. Scenes of various things happening.
Who's this? Bill Morrison.
Bill Morrison. Yeah, Decasia. Okay. I shouldn't really. It's not a film that I think is very interesting in itself, but it does have this kind of these remarkable images of nitrate stock that's reached a point of almost the images. You know, a lot of the images are slides around and
yeah. When was this made?
A few years ago.
But you're not keen to. You don't want to.
I think
promote
more interesting
film.
Works to talk about. Than
all
that
right,
one.
Okay. Because it sounds very much like the. I've got these CDs by someone called Baczynski, where it's music that sort of decomposes as it goes along. It sounds very much like on that idea. But you're not. You think it's too what? It's too aesthetic or something.
It's very kind of. He makes a kind of fetish of the decomposed image in a way, whereas I think that the stuff we're going to talk about is much more conceptually. You know, has a kind of conceptual purpose and clarity.
Right.
But I suppose, since we're talking about nitrate, it's worth mentioning that a lot of cinema projectors used to have, when I was a projectionist at the Scala in the late 70s, the projectors there had metal boxes to contain the film reels in, so that if a fire did break out, the fire could be contained within these metal boxes. So the feed and take up reels would be encased in a metal box, and also because a lot of early projectors had carbon arc lamp bulbs, which is to light the bulb, you have to push the two carbon rods together, and there's a spark, which then the rods fall back to a certain, they have a certain predetermined gap, which, and then the electricity arcs across the gap and creates the light. Rather, very beautiful kind of light, actually. And when I worked at the Electric Cinema Club, the manager there used to come up and switch it on for a few seconds and then switch it off again to light, and then lit his cigarette off the glowing end of the carbon rod, and he used to call it the most expensive cigarette lighter in the world.
So when did they go out of use?
That was in the late 70s. They were still used, the projectors there, and they'd belonged to Winston Churchill originally. I'm not sure exactly when people went over to xenon bulbs, but they were already in use then. I think these projectors were, everything there was pretty low-tech, old technology.
So do you remember cellulose nitrate film?
I've never handled any myself.
No. But it was pretty dangerous, I think.
Yeah.
It was capable of sort of destroying cinemas and whatever.
It's the same stuff, I think, as gun cotton, the same...
Really?
I think so. I think that's right. Yeah.
But apparently, when it decomposes, it produces a gas, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which then becomes sort of explosive within the can. I don't think it just always turns to sludge. I think it produces gas,
okay.
Which then sort of
right.
well, so we could say then that the early technology of film did contain within it was self-destructive in itself. I mean, there can't be many media which have that.
Element. But I think even with safety film, with the projector and the film running through it, there's always this kind of possibility that the projector will destroy the film, will chew it up.
Right.
And I mean, that can still happen now. Even now, the film is printed onto polyester, which you can't really tear or break easily at all. But it can still run off the rollers and get mashed up by the projector.
Yeah.
There's always that kind of dichotomous possibility in film projection.
Well, I remember at the Co-op once, there was Stan Brakhage used to just make unique prints. Apparently he was working on reversal film.
Right, yeah.
And so if he made a film, there was only one of them.
Yes.
And I think they showed one at the Co-op, and it got stuck in the gate.
Right.
And you could see the beam of the projector was literally burning a hole, and so the image was just sort of dissolving in the whole audience. There was a sort of gasp from the audience realizing that this unique film was sort of being, the frame was being burnt in front of their very eyes.
But, yes, yes. I was going to mention, since you mentioned that, another kind of self-consuming film, perhaps, which... we were going to talk about Annabelle Nicholson's Real Time, which is a really great example, early-ish example. But there's an artist called Emma Hart who made this film called Skin Film, where she's wrapped sellotape around her whole body and then stuck the tape down onto 16mm clear film. And she always projected the original artwork. She never projected a copy. And apparently inside, in the particles of skin that form the image, there are bacteria which eat the skin. And so the image, over a period of a year or so, the image gradually fades until there's nothing left. And so she remade the film, the same technique, remade it, and then remade it a second time. So there were three editions.
Right.
And then she decided that would be the end of that project. And it no longer exists. And she never made a photographic copy. So it's something, a film that disappeared.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So Annabelle Nicholson was a sort of prime prime mover in the film Co-op, do you think?
Yes, definitely.
She goes way back to the sort of Gloucester...
Yeah.
Gloucester, well, the Dairy
Gloucester,
period,
yeah.
I suppose.
Prince of Wales Crescent.
Right.
A road which no longer exists.
Is that right?
In Camden Town, Chalk Farm.
Yeah. And the old Co-op building has also been destroyed, I think. The Gloucester Road one, it's Gloucester Avenue, has been sort of also turned into luxury flats and so on.
Right.
But am I right in thinking that she was, at that time, I don't know if it's indiscreet or whatever, but she was involved with Paul Burwell, I think.
Yeah. They
were an item.
They were, and they also produced Musics magazine, which...
Oh, yeah.
I suppose it is a kind of precursor to... Well, it was produced as part of the London Musicians Collective, because the London Musicians Collective was next door to the film co-op on the same floor.
Okay.
So and she's also involved in that.
So maybe the piece that she is most known for, I think that if you look through sort of the various histories of avant-garde film that have been written, the one piece that she usually gets mentioned for doing is the one with the sewing machine.
Yes, Real Time.
Real Time.
Yeah.
Which is a self-destructive film piece or not?
It's two projectors. Well, it's not strictly self-destructive, but it involves the damaging and potentially destruction of the film strip. There are two projectors, but one projector has a film of her sewing. It's sitting at a sewing machine sewing it. It's a hand-operated sewing machine. And as the film runs, the film is looped around the room, around the space, and as the film runs through the projector, she also runs it through the sewing machine, so she punches a series of holes in it.
Right.
And that goes on until the film breaks or something happens like that or jams. And, I mean, one of the nice things about the piece is that the sewing machine mechanism is said to have given rise to the claw mechanism that pulls the film through the projector, through the camera and the projector, 35mm. The story is that one of the Lumiere brothers had a dream about the sewing machine mechanism, the gripper foot, which moves intermittently to pull the material, the fabric, through the machine. And in his dream, he found the solution to how they would get film to move intermittently through their cinematograph.
Yeah.
It's a nice story.
So it's like the claw mechanism in a projector or a camera, which moves the film on one frame.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But I suppose also a sewing machine... it has an adjustable pitch. But when you sew, it punches a series of holes in them, or thread through by punching holes through the fabric, and the pitch can be adjusted, so you can have very close fine stitches or broader ones.
Right.
So there are lots of analogies between.
Do you know when did she first do this?
1973.
Right.
The film is stated as.
And it was essentially a performance piece rather than it wasn't a film that you could ever hire, or I suppose you could hire her to do the performance.
Yeah, I would have thought so.
Or was it just a one-off event? Did she sort of just do it once and say that's the end of that?
I'm sure she did it more than once.
Right.
I saw it once and I know it had been, I'm sure it had been seen shown other times as
right,
well.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And who else we got?
Well, then
another
piece from around the same time, which is in a way the purest example I could find of self-destructive film, was a piece by Liz Rhodes and Ian Kerr, which was performed at the Festival of Expanded Cinema at the ICA in 1976, and that involved two 16mm projectors, and each. One with a loop of a 100-foot-long loop of black film, and the other one with a 100-long loop of clear film, running through these projectors and dragging along the floor, and just ran all day, every day for the duration of the festival, and every now and again, perhaps every hour or so, they would stop the projectors and photocopy a section of these film loops. So obviously, the black one became the emulsion got scratched away from the black one, the clear one picked up a lot of scratches and dirt, and so they ended up looking. More or less like each other. So it's an entropic process, really.
Right. So as one became darker, the other one got lighter, but they'd end up looking scratched as film does.
Yeah.
And as you said, I mean, it is a kind of... It does seem to be part of the intrinsic quality of film, doesn't it? That it does end up getting scratched. Mm. I mean, much more than any other... medium. Other media don't sort of deteriorate in the same way just by their use, as it were. I mean, it becomes a bit of a joke, doesn't it, in a way? I mean, people have made you get these things on TV where they deliberately, someone like Harry Enfield or something would show a film
with
all the scratches and combined with an old English sort of voice something.
I think if you think about Dropout on VHS tapes, Dropout is a... I mean, film scratches are very... They're a very direct manifestation of a material process of deterioration. It's rather like putting something under a microscope. You're seeing... The scratches you're seeing are enormously magnified, and they are... What you're seeing is... Well, it's light shining through, and directly... You're seeing directly the physical deterioration that's happened to the film, whereas with video dropout, which is on old rental videos, you'd get those white lines that appear and maybe the picture would roll over a couple of times. That's kind of at several removes. You're seeing something. You're seeing some part of coating has been removed from the tape, and that causes a momentary loss of signal, which then manifests as a white line or something. But you're not actually seeing a white line that's on the tape or a clear line. And the same with with digital glitching. When you see the picture goes all blocky and it freezes up momentarily. Oh, yeah. That kind of thing that you see with digital media. That's, again, it's almost like an electronic or the system interpreting the data or the lack of data in that kind of way. So it's a very indirect kind of manifestation of some kind of fault somewhere in the system. Mm. I mean, it's not, one can never be quite sure where the fault is in the system because you know, digital media is such the kind of aspects of them are so form one, almost like an indivisible unit. You know, I was thinking about this in relation to camcorders, modern camcorders, where the storage medium is now an SD card or something. So it's almost part of the hardware, really. You don't have that hardware-software distinction like you have with films and projectors, where you've got this machine which can destroy the film or it can project images. It perhaps do both,
right.
And then you've got the film running through it, which in many ways is antithetical to the machine and quite distinct from the machine. Whereas with something like a modern camcorder, the card that you're storing your data on is part of, it's all part of the same one unit, which does everything. It records, plays back.
Right.
You can do everything within a single device. Whereas film is a series of stages.
Yes.
And there's something about that. Well, I'm just going off on a bit of a tangent, actually.
No, it's fascinating. I mean, because that sounds like that would, to most people, that would suggest why use film at all, because this, you know, because it sounds like it's doomed to fail in the light of the improved technology.
Mm.
But strangely enough, the galleries are still full of 16mm projectors. Mm. I went to the Listen Gallery only a couple of weeks ago, and there's a Rodney Graham show in one gallery, and then you go up to the other gallery up the road, and they've got four 16mm projectors with loops just running continuously. Yeah. Mm. To the extent that it has become a cliche, really, hasn't it? An art world cliche to have the 16mm film loop running.
Yeah, somebody told me that Basel Art Fair there were about 20 galleries all showing 16mm right. films on loopers.
Right.
Which is extraordinary.
It is a bit odd, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's strange the way they've retrospectively kind of embraced this technology as though it had something significant about it in itself.
Yes.
But anyway. Anyway, what about the Takeo Miura piece you...
That's another one. The Circle and the Square, and I couldn't find a date. The Circle and the Square, I couldn't find a date for it. But that's a really beautiful... That's also a performance piece. It's rather like Annabelle Nicholson's real-time film. And I saw this at the Lux a few years ago. He has, a black loop of film running through a 16mm projector, and the loop hangs down into where potentially the projector beam is, except there isn't a beam because the loop is black.
Uh-huh.
And then all the lights are turned out, and this was done in a very dark space full of people, and he sat in the middle of the space with a little hole punch, punching holes in the loop as it goes through the projector. So every few seconds he would grab the film, punch a hole, and then after a while you start to see those holes.
Yeah.
As they go through the projector gate, you get a flash of light on the screen.
Right.
And eventually you get more and more of those because there are more and more holes. And so you start to see a kind of double projection. You see these flashes of light, but they also illuminate the bit of loop that's hanging down into the projector beam.
Yeah.
So you see that
so
also projected, kind
shadow
of silhouetted.
Of some sort.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's like a sort of double projector. It's beautiful, really beautiful piece, very simple.
Okay.
And that goes on until it finishes when the film breaks. So it might last 5 minutes or it might last 20 minutes. I think the version I saw lasted about 20, 25 minutes. It was...
some bits and pieces. And that's probably the first film that I'm aware of where that was the case.
Right.
And then... Volman, also a letterist, made a couple of films. And then, do you have any other examples?
I do. jumping in enthusiastically.
No, that's all right.
From there's a very good essay by Jonathan Wally called "The Paris Cinema of Anthony McCall and Tony Conrad," which appeared in this book, Avant-Garde Film, which was papers from a conference in Edinburgh about 3 years ago. It's published by Rodopi, Amsterdam University Press. It's a rather heavy-duty academic publication, but it's a very good essay, really about... It's about kind of medium specificity, and it's a kind of critique of that. But he talks partly about Anthony McCall's solid light films, Line Describing a Cone, and which people might be familiar with. But the rest of the essay is devoted to Tony Conrad.
Hmm.
Maybe I could just read a little, because it's quite a funny description. In Tony Conrad's Paris cinema, material is foregrounded, but in ways that either paradoxically render the film impossible to view in a normal way, or that make unexpected and provocative substitutions of filmic elements like emulsion-based screen projection processing and exposure, so that the resulting works highlight these elements but are nonetheless barely recognisable as films. One example is 4X Attack, which is from 1973, for which Conrad hammered 50 feet of film into hundreds of tiny pieces. It sounds like a counterpart to the chiselling film.
Yeah.
He then carefully collected and returned the pieces to the film box, exposed to light for a fraction of a second, processed in a cheesecloth sack, and painstakingly glued back together. Though the original was too delicate to be projected, Conrad made a contact print so the projection could reveal the abstract patterns of light and shade that resulted from the flash exposure and the trauma inflicted by the hammering. And then there's another one called Deep Fried 4X Negative. 4X Negative is an old Kodak, discontinued Kodak stock. And by the way, on their website, they have a list, a chronology of discontinued stocks. This is from 1973. Deep Fried 4X Negative, which could only be viewed as a grilled and melted mass of raw film stock, still wound around a core in its original film can. And another one, 12 versions of another film called Pickled 3M150 from 1974. Small pieces of that stock in small pickling glass pickling jars filled with vinegar. Because the films do not have a duration determined by projection, Conrad believes that the films run indefinitely. So I suppose there's a kind of conceptual sense in which are they still films because they don't have a duration, a fixed duration, in the way that most movies we do.
I did read a bit about Conrad, and I think he curried some, didn't he?
He did, and threw it at the screen as well.
Yes, that was interesting. Where he painted the screen. Apparently, he would do hand painted screens as well, which changed their colour, I think, over time.
Yeah.
But the bit that I read about Conrad was that the films sort of, whatever he did to them, at the end of the day, really they kind of ended up looking a bit like Brackage or something, because it all, you know, whatever he's done to the film, if it gets projected, it's what is the end result? I mean, I suppose you, if you've had a description of the process, you can think about the process whilst you're looking at it.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that they differ essentially to Stan Brakhage.
Except that the intention is entirely different, I think. I think Conrad's got a much more kind of radical critique of film and that kind of aesthetic use of film. I don't think he's interested in aesthetic questions.
Right.
I think he's interested in questions about what is film and how does one define it, also in an institutional sense or in a sense of how is one to make sense of something which calls itself a film but really isn't, as Jonathan Wally says, you know, isn't a film in any normal understandable sense, except that he's literally used film.
Yeah.
I mean, the pickling piece, it's been running for 30 years. It says the strips of film in the jars have gone almost entirely clear, and the gases emitted during the pickling process have corroded the metal lids on the jars. So, I mean, you're getting quite a long way away from...
Well, sure. It's definitely not film as we know it, no. Or as it's not film like cinema.
There's another one which roast Calvar from 1974, where he wound a length of Calvar print stock 3,000 times, producing a twisted mass whose ends were stapled together to preserve the helix-like shape. Also, it was also exposed to light like the 4X Attack, and then baked in an oven, rendering the film crisp and delicate. Needless to say, the film is unprojectable. It's kept in a small wooden box and wrapped in a hairnet to protect it from chipping as it is passed around the audience for viewing.
Okay. Well, what about perhaps we can sort of quickly move on to Antonioni's film Blow Up.
Oh yeah,
which is obviously a piece of cinema very far removed from Hairnets and Carried Film Stock. And so do you remember that film? Obviously you do.
Yes, I guess we're thinking of the scene with the Yardbirds, where where Jeff Beck's amplifier goes on the blink and
that's
gets very
right.
annoyed very quickly.
There's a lot of stories around this scene, aren't there? I mean, Blow Up was made in 1966 by Antonioni and includes this sort of scene of sort of smashing a guitar, but it's rather a kind of, it's a bit of a cheap kind of version of what The Who were obviously trying to do. And there are various, they play a track, it's The Yardbirds, which includes at the time Keith Relf, Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck. There were various other groups were asked to do the piece, weren't they?
Oh, really?
There was a group called The In Crowd. Who were dropped for the Yardbirds. Apparently even Eric Burdon and the Velvet Underground were asked. Who were asked to do it.
Wow.
But none of them were available or you know, it would have been too expensive to do it. So they ended up with the Yardbirds. And then Jeff Beck does this sort of Pete Townsend type
rather
stunt.
Rather lame and not very enthusiastically.
And apparently people... You know, that know about guitars, look at it and say, "Oh, it's just a cheap guitar he's used." Actually, it wasn't a Rickenbacker like Pete Townshend used. Okay, well, we're rapidly hurtling towards the end of the show again. Thank you very much to Nicky Hamlin for talking about self-destructive film, and we sort of agreed to end up, I think, with a track by The Who, a very early track by The Who, 1965. This is "I Can't Explain." Do you like this track, Nicky?
I do.
Good.
I do, yeah.
All right. Well, take it away, Pete.